I too am very pleased to be here. I'm very pleased to be here on behalf of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. I'm grateful, very grateful, to the civil society organisations which have worked so hard to convene the event, and I'm also very grateful for the interesting material that I'm seeing that you're producing, which I'm happy to take back and get others to emulate in different places. I know most of your organisations, and certainly the office has had a bit to do with these organisations in various contexts. I'm also very thankful to those who have supported the conference financially. Those who support these sorts of things really contribute to building capacity to promote, protect and implement human rights in this part of the United Kingdom. Now, next Wednesday will be the 10th of December, and that day is Human Rights Day. It commemorates the adoption on that day, just around midnight, it could have been the 11th of December, in 1948, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the United Nations General Assembly. Just as in the case of the United Nations Charter adopted 3 years earlier, the Declaration is the result of leadership, vision, and courage. It is well known that Eleanor Roosevelt, and we've already heard of her this morning, and René Cassin took the lead in drafting the declaration with the strong support of John Humphrey, the director of the UN Division on Human Rights. But many of the declaration's provisions are drawn from drafts submitted by civil society organisations and respond to their determined and persistent lobbying. But it's a pity we've still got the Brotherhood. It is remarkable to recall, however, that in 1948, only 41 non-governmental organisations held the consultative status with United Nations Economic and Social Council, which is a precondition for participation in the United Nations intergovernmental work. Today, 3,900 organisations have this status, and tens of thousands more at the regional, sub-regional, national and local levels are involved with the UN, many in the field of human rights. Many of the individuals working for these organisations, however, do so despite intimidation or real risk that they, their families, or others connected with them may suffer reprisals because of their work. In contrast to the early days of the United Nations, also, there is now a vast number of civil society organisations engaged in human rights work in the Global South, and I'm happy that we have some of representatives of some of those organisations with us over these 2 days. The Universal Declaration retains its power to strike a deep chord of response. If you read its words, it's very powerful, very, very slim in language, but extremely, extremely visionary. Professor Henry Steiner puts it well. He says, no other document has so caught the historical moment, achieved the same moral and rhetorical force, or exerted as much influence. It was unprecedented and marked a turning point in international law and international relations. It's in fact subversive because for the very first time it subordinated the principle of state sovereignty to the enjoyment by individuals of freedom of speech and belief and freedom from fear and want. This declaration has inspired a large body of binding human rights treaties whose legal norms, states which become party to which states become party, are bound to promote, protect and fulfil. And it continues to inspire further standard setting, such as with respect to the human rights of older persons. And I see we have an organisation working in that context with us today. Today we have 9 core human rights treaties and their substantive protocols, which set out state obligations on civil, cultural, economic, political, and social rights. And these are to be enjoyed by all without discrimination on any grounds, such as race, colour, sex, language, religion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. Several of these establish specific regimes to address those whose situation requires further attention. They include people who experience racial discrimination, women who experience discrimination on the grounds of sex, migrant workers, children, and persons with disabilities. Others focus on particular human rights concerns, such as torture or enforced disappearance, which sadly still goes on. 10 human rights treaty bodies comprised of committees of independent experts working for nothing, pro bono, have been created to encourage implementation of those norms by states' parties. They do so through scrutiny of states' parties' periodic reports, which describe how they implement the treaties in particular contexts and usually describe in very glowing terms, receipt and consideration of individual petitions, and conduct of inquiries on the spot. The Human Rights Council and its predecessor, the Commission on Human Rights, have also developed mechanisms which have the same objective. Currently, we have 53 council special procedures. These are actually people, individual independent experts, or working groups made up of 5 independent experts who address human rights situations in countries or address human rights themes which range from enforced disappearance. The first mechanism was devoted to enforced disappearance and extrajudicial execution, to minority issues, disability issues, and universal coercive measures in all countries of the world. Each reports annually to the Human Rights Council, and the majority also to the General Assembly. Each conducts visits to at least 2 countries every year, and reports on these visits to the Council. And when those visits take place, there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of discussion with civil society, with government, and all those who are very concerned with the particular issue that the rapporteur deals with. And I imagine some of you will recall the visits of the Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing and the visit of the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women to the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland last year. There was a lot of excitement about that. By and large, both of these rapporteurs ended up very unpopular insofar as government was concerned, but they did identify issues and certainly excited civil society. These rapporteurs also transmit confidential appeals on the human rights situation of individuals to states and issue public statements on individual and general human rights concerns. The Council has shown leadership by responding to patterns of grave human rights violations by adopting country resolutions, these established country rapporteurs, convening special sessions on state situations, and creating commissions of inquiry, fact-finding missions and investigation. During 2014, we at OHCHR have supported 5 of these mechanisms, one on Eritrea, one on Gaza, another on Iraq and Sri Lanka and Syria, and we have also been providing support to a commission of inquiry on the Central African Republic, which was established by the United Nations Security Council. Now, you'll all be familiar with the Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review Mechanism, and I've seen the contributions from Northern Ireland civil society to that review of the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland. The creation of this mechanism is another story of leadership, and you know that this is a mechanism through which the human rights record of each member state of the United Nations is considered by its peers. It's really a unique combination of bilateral and multilateral human rights diplomacy. Civil society, as I say, has a key role to play in this mechanism, and the mechanism has led to changes in legislation and policy in many states. So in short, as I've described, a comprehensive legal and institutional framework of human rights promotion and protection is in place at the international level. And the existence of all the component parts of this legal framework and institutional framework required the leadership and investment of states and other actors, and in particular civil society, people such as yourselves. Just over 20 years ago also, in 1993, United Nations member states agreed the Vienna Declaration and Programme of Action. This confirmed the interdependence and universality of human rights and rejected the notion of cultural relativism. In other words, we do human rights differently from the way you do human rights. It also provided much-needed impetus for the advances we've seen in women's human rights, the rights of children, minorities, and persons with disabilities. In fact, just after the conference, I wrote an account of the way civil society used the preparatory process for this conference and the conference itself to reclaim the vision set out in the Universal Declaration for women and girls. Courageously, the conference agreed an old but contested proposal, also spearheaded by civil society, the creation of the mandate of a High Commissioner for the Promotion and Protection of All Human Rights. In December of that year, 1993, the General Assembly established this mandate, giving the High Commissioner a strong and independent voice on thematic and country-related human rights issues. We've had quite a few human rights commissioners now, and all of them, including the most recent appointee, Commissioner Zayed, have embraced this role, and embracing the role have shown leadership and courage with respect to urgent and chronic country situations and themes. And they do this through diplomatic dialogue at the highest levels and public advocacy. Indeed, a recent monograph on the High Commissioner for Human Rights is subtitled Conscience for the World. So, the UN human rights architecture, born through leadership, provides us with leaders to advocate change in human rights behaviour. But the important question is, of course, whether this makes any difference at all, or what were we, an industry, a human rights industry? Are these just building blocks in what could be described as an industry? For me, the answer is an emphatic yes, and what I'm going to do is to provide you with several examples where the voices of state, civil society, independent human rights mechanisms, and the High Commissioner, all independent from each other, have converged and caused a sea change in certain areas. Now, let me first talk about the death penalty. You from Northern Ireland will remember that the last execution here took place in December 1961, and the death penalty for murder was abolished in 1973. But the legal system of many countries retains this penalty. International human rights law provides that the death sentence may be imposed only for the most serious crimes and pursuant to a decision of a competent court. Independent human rights mechanisms, including the special rapporteurs on torture and extrajudicial executions, have delineated the parameters of these preconditions. And as recently as Tuesday, these mandates called on the United States and the authorities of the state of Texas to halt the execution of a convicted prisoner with proven psychosocial disabilities who had waived his right to counsel and represented himself during his trial. High commissioners have also advocated for abolition of this sentence and moratoria on its application. They do so bilaterally and through high-level events, such as one which is now ongoing in Algiers. And interestingly, Algeria has been pretty good in terms of a moratorium on the death penalty. And at that Algerian meeting, we have the participation of governments from North Africa and the Middle East. And, of course, those countries do retain, and many of them do not have, a moratorium on its application. We've seen progress. This sounds like a talk shop, but on the 21st of November, the Third Committee of the General Assembly adopted its fifth resolution on moratoria on the use of the death penalty. It did so by a recorded vote, which means it's not a consensus that the death penalty is a bad thing. It was 114 to 36, so 114 states call for a moratorium on the death penalty. In 2012, 111 to 41 was the recorded vote. So we've seen a shift. It's 5 years, it's only a few countries, but six countries, but it's a shift. And as far as I'm concerned, it's an enormous shift. Today, 160 of the 193 member states of the UN have abolished the death penalty or introduced moratoria, either in law or practice. I've got no scientific evidence, but I think the pressure of the human rights movement helped here. Secondly, it's been a long struggle to obtain recognition that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are indeed people who have the same human rights as everyone else. Starting in the early 20th century in some countries and much more recently in others, LGBT human rights activists have increasingly organised themselves and condemned the injustice, abuse, violence, and discriminatory laws which marked the lives of LGBT persons at the national level in many countries. It was only in March 1994 that the United Nations Human Rights Committee declared in a petition against Australia that criminalising consensual sexual relations between adults of the same sex violated the human rights to privacy and freedom from discrimination. Since then, UN human rights mechanisms, informed and indeed pushed by civil society, have built up a solid body of jurisprudence condemning all forms of violence and discrimination against LGBT people. And these have been codified in a collection of principles, which were produced in 2006, called the Yogyakarta Principles. In 2003, Brazil showed courage and sought to introduce a resolution at the Commission on Human Rights which condemned these discriminatory and indeed violent practices. But unfortunately, at that time, there wasn't sufficient support in the Council to actually have the resolution introduced. However, soft and indeed hard advocacy from all sides increased the pressure on member states to take decisive action. In June 2011, the first UN resolution initiated by South Africa, so here we have a real example of leadership, expressed grave concern at acts of violence and discrimination against LGBT persons, and that was adopted by the Human Rights Council. This mandated the very first UN report exposing the pattern of discrimination and violence against LGBT people and challenged states to fulfil their obligation to protect all human persons from human rights violations. I have to say it wasn't an easy process, and it was one of the, not exciting, one of the more depressing days within the Human Rights Council, as there were those who were unprepared to vote in favour of this resolution, thereby indicating that there was toleration for severe discrimination, abuse and violence in this context. Last September, four South American countries sponsored another resolution, reiterating the call for UN action and requesting a report for the June session of the Council next year. Again, this was a resolution adopted by vote. It was less depressing this time as there was more consensus, but still there's a body of states which is prepared not to go along with the consensus on this resolution. UN advocacy in this context has been led by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and particularly the former High Commissioner, Navi Pillay. And any of you who have tracked Navi Pillay's career will know that she herself began as a grassroots human rights activist in South Africa. She has been passionate in making the case for equal protection of the rights of LGBT persons. And she's even been able to enlist the support of the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. We have an extremely visible and innovative campaign called Free and Equal, which was launched in June last year. And we've seen that it's captured the imagination of people from all regions and reached out to more than 1 billion individuals. And we've seen change in attitudes, legislation, and policies. And we've also seen change in the judiciary. A very interesting recent case by a Botswanan bench does reject the notion of discrimination and violence against LGBT people. I've got lots more examples. I could go on and speak all day about what happens at the international level and how that is brought about and what it does at the national level. But I wanted to particularly highlight the work of Farida Shahid, the Special Rapporteur on Cultural Rights. And this work is unique. Her work has focused on how history is taught and narrated in divided societies and how cultural rights can guide us in this context. And in doing that, she had the profound input of the Northern Ireland Commission on Human Rights. In 2013 and 2014, Farida decided to investigate the writing and teaching of history, and especially history textbooks. Not surprisingly for me, as an Australian and an Australian of Irish traveller descent, she found that in many countries, the history taught in schools is often problematic from a human rights perspective. In fact, the history taught to me didn't in any way correspond with reality where Aboriginal Australians were concerned. She found that too often education policies relating to history teaching fail to acknowledge cultural diversity and the multiplicity of historical narratives among and within communities. As a result, she found communities feel that they've been excluded or misrepresented. She also considered memorialisation processes and discovered that states emerging from conflicts or periods of repression are increasingly engaging in active memorial policies as a means of ensuring recognition for the victims, as reparation for mass or grave violations of human rights, and as a guarantee of non-recurrence. The ways in which narratives are memorialised, however, have far-reaching consequences. Entire cultural and symbolic landscapes are designed through memorials and museums, reflecting, but also shaping negatively or positively, social interaction and people's self-identification, and indeed their perception of other social groups. The Special Rapporteur consulted with the Northern Ireland Commission on Human Rights in July 2013, and this consultation, the report of it, forms the backdrop of her report on the role of cultural rights in countries emerging from conflict. And the report of the Northern Ireland Commission on Human Rights was part of the documentation of the Human Rights Council at its March session this year. And I see that you have a very nicely packaged report of that consultation, and I'm very grateful to see it and very grateful to take it away. One of the most exciting days for me in the Human Rights Council, and I do find the Human Rights Council very exciting, was this September, where there was a panel discussion on history teaching and memorialisation processes aimed to contribute to the sharing of good practices in this area. And one particularly striking example was Side by Side, which is a book which has the narratives of Palestine and Israel side by side with regard to the history of that very troubled area. Now, my feeling is that leadership at the international level to advance human rights remains as critical today as it was during the early years of the United Nations, and of course 1948 was the big year. All of us have a role to play, however. States, the High Commissioner, his office, human rights mechanisms, including the Council, treaty body experts and special procedures, but most importantly, civil society. Civil society is on the ground, knows what's going on. Leadership is particularly crucial to translate the vision of the Universal Declaration from rhetoric to reality, to take it from the page and bring it to the ground. I just want to end on a sober note, and I think it's something that we should be very, very conscious of. Human rights are empowering, and the international human rights machinery has become increasingly visible. And more people who can't get what they should get on the ground turn to the human rights machinery to vindicate their rights. Now, I've just come from Geneva, where the third forum on business and human rights is taking place, and there were 2,000 participants. 2,000 people felt it was appropriate to come to Geneva to talk about business and human rights. And they were Indigenous people, they were people, there were minority people who'd all been affected in some way by the behaviour of business. Now, no state enjoys criticism. The whole idea is a state is great. They love creating these human rights mechanisms. They generally think we're creating them because of the others. They just don't like being criticised. And those visits of Rachel Rodnick and Rashida Manjoo to the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland are very good examples of a very developed democratic state showing that it really doesn't like criticism at all, and describing both of these women, who are in their more or less my age, and I suppose they describe me in the same way, as being essentially mad and wearing strange glasses and odd clothes. And, of course, because of that, they have no right saying things like, there is violence against women, huh? And there's a problem with some housing policies and legislation. That was, I suppose, being told that you wear funny clothes and you have red glasses and your hair is dyed is okay, but other states work very hard to discourage any negative international attention. Some of them intimidate civil society and especially human rights defenders, or engage in reprisals, or encourage or condone such acts if they are carried out by others. Now, we at the UN are not well placed to provide protection, although the Secretary General and the High Commissioner strongly condemn this behaviour. This is another area where leadership and courage are key. We must all work in a united way to end intimidation and reprisals for human rights work, because after all, it's your human right. Thank you so much.